Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. You know, I love talking to authors who have the courage to take their thoughts, put it down on a piece of paper, and share it with the many, because it could end up changing the world or their legacy or their destiny. And if you're looking to write a book out there, check out dreamstarterspublishing.com. We can help you out with wherever you're at in the process. And if you have a book that's already done, use bookmarketingcrm.com, put your book on autopilot, and generate leads with it. The book we're talking about today is called Advanced Manufacturing, The New American Innovation Policies. And it's really all about how to rethink innovation and revitalize America's declining manufacturing sector. I've had a few guests that have books in regards to this, so it's going to be an honor to talk with William, but he goes by Bill Bonvillian. Great to be here, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mike.
Let's start off with the genesis of this book. What made you want to sit down and write Advanced Manufacturing?
You know, a lot of us have seen this problem, right? A lot of us have seen this kind of ongoing decline in American manufacturing, which has been going on for some time. And I wanted to write it to kind of get to the bottom of that story. What actually happened? Why? And what do we want to do about it? So yeah. Those really were the motivations.
Yeah. So I think that it's, when I look back at some of the things that happened right around the late 1800s, 1900s, or early 1900s, you start to look at maybe the steel industry. I think it was 1912 is when U.S. Steel became the biggest company. All of a sudden, you see that being bought out by Nippon Steel. Whether it went through or not, I'm not sure. But I mean, American manufacturing declining like crazy, and it's not looking better. So what was the start of it all?
You know, at the time World War II broke out, Mike, U.S. manufacturing was absolutely king of the world, right? This is before the war, right? Yeah. The production capacity of Germany, we had 8 times the production capacity of Japan. By the end of the war, we were kings of manufacturing, even more so, right? Mm-hmm. So when we began to think at the end of World War II, what's our innovation system going to look like? Because there was a huge amount of innovation that came out of World War II. You know, radar, which really led to American electronics, and the very, very beginnings of computing began in World War II, and incredible advances in medicine, you know, penicillin and antibiotics, and a whole set of much less atomic weapons. And therefore atomic energy, just a host of stuff came out of World War II. What was our innovation system going to look like? We began looking at how to do it. And we decided to organize a really strong research-based system, because going into the war, the U.S. wasn't the strongest science power, right? Germany, Britain, some other countries, they were stronger in science. We got stronger in science during the course of the war. Let's hold on to that. That was the problem. Let's make sure we fixed it. So we focused, we built an R&D system, second to none, mm-hmm. course of the war. We decided to keep it, but we didn't even think about manufacturing because we were kings of manufacturing. So when we worked on putting that innovation system together, and I'm talking about particularly the federal role in research and development, we just paid no attention to innovation and manufacturing. And we paid a tremendous cost for that. So when we do R&D in the United States, it's not about new manufacturing processes. It's not about new manufacturing technologies. We just didn't build that into the system. I think that's a really big failing. So something which has been going on in recent years, you know, in the past, we used to talk about fixes to the manufacturing problems of being trade or tax or the value of the dollar. And those are all important, no mm-hmm. question. But we never thought about applying our innovation system to it. Could we innovate our way out of this trouble? And that's what's been going on in recent years. And that's kind of what I'm writing about.
So if I were, and I didn't read your book yet, but I would think that it started to really fall right around the 70s. And maybe that had to do with stagflation, or whether it had to do with rising regulations, with inflation in general, or potentially the rise of unions that would actually crumble a lot of companies. When you see the countries that really started to produce a lot, whether it was China or Japan, I mean, the regulations were down. Also, the unions, I don't think they even existed there for a long time. So they were able to produce at a much lower cost. There was less red tape. So am I onto something there, that regulation and unions.
Yeah, those were no question about it. There were issues there. But, you know, what happened was that, you know, the U.S. was like the big technology innovator in manufacturing, right, for about 100 years, right? So, you know, we came up with, starting in the 1830s, we came up with interchangeable machine-made parts, mm-hmm. right, which enabled us to kind of begin to systematize production. And then we added to that the Ford Motor Plant, right, the assembly system, right? We added those things. And then we took advantage of the fact that we were a continent-sized economy. Nobody else had a continent-sized economy. We did. And we connected that continent with great transportation systems, right? So we were making products and then we were selling them into this continent-sized market, right? So we developed mass production in a way that nobody else was close to. And that's what led us into World War II, this huge production advantage we had in World War II, right? Was this, because we had figured out mass production. Post-war, what happens? A new innovation wave is launched by Japan, which figures out quality production, right? Mm-hmm. Way to produce higher quality goods at a much more competitive kind of price, right? And they launched this quality revolution. We missed it. We weren't doing innovation and manufacturing. They did it. And that set us behind. The whole auto industry fell
late 70s, early 80s. It all shifted.
We were producing, you know, big fins. And Japan was producing highly efficient, extremely well-made cars, right? We were producing junkers, frankly. So they yeah. captured the auto sector. They also captured the consumer electronics sector, right? Those all came at tremendous cost to U.S. manufacturing. But then the big challenge that we've got going on now is China. And China's output is now 31% of the world's manufacturing output. Ours used to be there, right? We've traded places completely. You know, we're now down, you know, at like 16%, right? We've totally flipped with China. And, you know, they passed our manufacturing output in 2011. And look, it's not just cheap labor, right? We all think it's, oh, they got to have manufacturing because it's cheap labor. It's a much more complicated story than that. China has figured out a lot of innovation in production too. They've got the ability to scale up production in a sector much more rapidly than we can scale it up, right? Mm. They can stand up whole new sectors much more quickly than we can. And so there's a lot of innovation capability that we're just trying to understand at this point that China's been able to invoke. And now they're embarking on a massive new effort to do advanced manufacturing, whereas we're still thinking about it. So look, how are we going to compete, right? We can do a couple of things. One, we can lower our wages to China's wage levels. Great, right? People are going to be real happy about that one, right? Or we can figure out how to get much more efficient and much more productive, right? We could do that. We're innovators, right? We could do it if we put our minds to it. And that's essentially the case this book makes, is that we got to turn to the innovation system and kind of innovate our way back into competition here. Because everything else we do, tax policy, trade policy, dollar policy, those are fleeting. Those are transitory. Building an innovation advantage, that lasts for a long time. And we haven't had it. So let's do that.
I mean, I would think that a lot of this starts in the education system, right? You start to maybe create a pathway to innovation right from the get-go. And it seems like with your background, if you could just kind of share a little bit about who you are and where you come from, because I'm looking at your background and it's pretty damn impressive. So how did you get from, I guess, where you started, and I don't know exactly where you started, but you're all over the place in this bio to where you're at now. Tell us a little bit about that pathway.
Sure. Well, I mean, two pieces. You know, one was that, you know, I worked for Senator Joe Lieberman, recently deceased, in the U.S. Senate for about 15 years. And he worked on the Armed Services Committee. And so I did a lot of learn the kind of R&D system, particularly the defense R&D system and agencies like DARPA. I learned that system well. And then worked for MIT, and MIT has a little Washington office that I ran for them, and they handle MIT's dealings with all the R&D agencies. MIT does a lot of research, a lot of ongoing relationships with the R&D agencies. What do they want to do? Where do they want to go? And then what does MIT think about where they want to go, right? It's that kind of exchange that I was managing. So I did that and, you know, stepped down from that about 6 years ago and really began focusing on more writing and research and teaching in MIT. So that's what I've been doing. And this manufacturing book was a chance to really think hard about what's been happening in U.S. manufacturing and ways to try and improve the situation.
So I was reading an article, and I believe it had to do with DARPA, but money is being put into, I think, what DARPA is the arm of the government that implements all kinds of new technology. Is that right? So maybe you can clarify on exactly what DARPA is. But from what I understand, there's money going into, I think it's DARPA, to build trains on the moon. And I'm thinking to myself, what a waste of resources. They could be doing wonders. What are they doing? Like you said, there's this major crisis when it comes to manufacturing. I think there's so much waste in government. It's mind-blowing, but they can fix it if they divert their resources to one solution. What are your thoughts? What is the DARPA system? What have you seen, if you're able to share anything from it? But also, do you agree with my sentiment?
Yeah, they're not putting trains on the moon, Mike.
Saw that. I'm like, oh, who's doing this? Who signed off on this crap?
Not sure who's doing that. But DARPA is, it's what it, what its name says. It's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So it does defense technologies, and often that overlaps with the civilian economy for sure. It does advanced research. So DARPA is only interested in breakthroughs and kind of revolutionary breakthroughs. It's not interested in just incremental research. It does projects. So it's not just doing, you know, research for the sake of research. It wants something to happen with its projects, right? And it's an agency. So it's got, you know, a certain amount of cloud as a separate organization and $8 billion. What has it done for us? Well, I mentioned the internet a minute ago, but it also brought about lots of the IT revolution. Played a critical role in the development of personal computing, lots of advances in semiconductors and lithography that were critical to kind of building that IT revolution. You know, it gave us stealth, it gave us the GPS handheld.
Yep.
You know, lately it developed a lot of the science behind mRNA, and it became the vaccine during the pandemic. It's a very interesting, very innovative organization, organized in a very different way than the rest of the federal government science system.
Well, you know, one of the big...
But it hasn't been on manufacturing, Mike.
Oh. Right?
Again, turning our system onto these manufacturing challenges and getting us the technologies we need. That's a key story. And look, the scientists and engineers are telling us that we could do this new kind of advanced manufacturing. We can do digital production. We can do advanced robotics. We can do data analytics and AI at scale. We can do new kinds of advanced materials. We can do bio and nano fabrication. We can do 3D printing at large scale. There's all kinds of technologies waiting to kind of pick up and put into our manufacturing system. And we need to embark on that.
And so one of the rebuttals I have from people who say the government did create a lot of jobs, they always bring up DARPA and what they were able to do with that, with the GPS and the computers and all that. So I really don't have a way to fight back, because I know they gave a lot to the world. But just to just to kind of refresh anybody, if they saw me post it all over social media. But there is an article from last month at the end of March. The defense DARPA, an ambitious federal innovations division, has begun collaborating with over a dozen companies on potential future lunar technologies, including a moon railroad. It's called the 10-Year Lunar Architecture Capability Study, or LUNA 10. Amazing. I just think about this. I'm like, oh, my God, what is going on in this world? So regardless.
If Elon Musk actually gets us there, we might as well figure out something to do with it, right?
Yeah. Right. I'm with you. If somebody actually gets us there, come on, Elon, finally get us on the moon, right? So you do have some, maybe some remedies. There's a lot of startup entrepreneurs that that listen to this podcast. So I think in your book, later on in the book, you talk about some, maybe some solutions for startup entrepreneurs in this world. Do you have anything you could share with us?
Sure. There's a series of things I think we need to do. And one of those things is to really work on better mechanisms for scale-up financing. So, you know, as I think you know, Mike, venture capital is really focused on software and to some extent biotech and services, right? It's not focused on hardware, which is a very small percentage of what venture funds. Why? Because hardware takes a long time to evolve. It's kind of outside the timetable for what venture wants to do, and it's high risk. So the timetable and the risk portfolio just don't match with what venture capital, the gains it can achieve in areas like software or biotech. But, you know, what that means is that we're not in, frankly, hard tech produces a lot more jobs. So we're not really investing in areas that we're going to, and we need venture, right? We for sure need venture capital. But we need to figure out what the signaling system is going to be to create incentives for venture to take on these longer term, higher risk, hard tech kinds of challenges. I'd say that's a top concern, right? And we don't have scale up financing in general for manufacturing. Just to tell you what China does, recent reports indicate that it spends about $400 billion a year just on manufacturing scale-up subsidies for its firm, which accounts for, frankly, a lot of its dominance in world manufacturing output. The U.S. is essentially doing nothing like that. So we really need to tackle, I'm not saying do it in the public sector. Let's figure out what the signals are that we can incentivize the private sector to do this better. Let's improve the manufacturing institutes. This is a public-private partnership model. Industry-led involves, you know, engineering-oriented universities, and brings in lots of companies, including a lot of smaller companies and startups. And they're organized around particular technologies like digital production or 3D printing. And the idea there is to get around the fact that our R&D system hasn't really paid much attention to manufacturing innovation. Let's start innovating in the manufacturing field and bringing on these new technologies, but have them developed by industry with some government seed funding. So that's an interesting idea, but we've underfunded those institutes. It's really a small program, and we need some significant additional support there. I think the model is right. The public-private partnership model is right, but we need to do more there. We have a lot of government procurement. Government buys a lot of stuff, particularly the Defense Department. Let's tell the Defense Department to use its procurement power to buy technologies that are made with these new advanced manufacturing technologies and processes, right? We did that once, right? CNC equipment was developed actually in part at my school at MIT. And it was kind of going nowhere, but the Defense Department tested it and figured out that with CNC, computer numerical controlled equipment machining, we could get much more precise parts. And the Air Force and the Defense Department really needed those for much more precise missile parts. So they told industry, okay, you want a contract with the federal government for missiles? You have to use CNC equipment. And by the way, you can lease it from us at a good price. So the federal government helped introduce these manufacturing technologies by using its procurement power. It was good for the federal government. It got much higher quality, drove the price down, introduced new technologies. But it was also very good for the private sector. It gave new competitive advantages to our private sector. So those are some of the policies I think we need to consider. And a deep underlying one is to really work on workforce education. That's a story in itself, but that's another part of this puzzle because we don't have the manufacturing workforce ready to implement these technologies. We're just not going to get there.
Yeah, good point. I mean, I have a lot of clients in the trades business, and they talk about how there, it's getting scarce. The amount of people even getting into the trades alone is, it's scary, but they are going to be able to write their own tickets in 5 years, 10 years from now. The amount of money that they can make if they get into it, because it's, it doesn't seem like the workforce is there. So very few people, but if they started focusing on it, it might come back.
Yeah, this is a big underlying issue for the country, particularly in manufacturing, but it's an issue in general. And we just have a broken workforce education system, frankly. There's a huge gap, and this is in the book too. There's a huge gap between, you know, the education system and the workforce, right? They're not connected. There's a whole bunch of countries that have figured out how to make those connections work, like deep, effective apprenticeship system. And, you know, in your high school years, you're also in apprenticeship, learning, you know, highly skilled, good paying skills, but you're also going to school at the same time.
Yep.
That's an important step. And we just haven't tackled that in the U.S. We still have this big gap between learning and work.
So what are your thoughts on the AI developments that we've seen recently? My opinion, AI is going to wipe out a lot of jobs. And I think it's a time for many people to pivot. And if the individuals are in school, maybe by the time they get out of school, the job they're trying to pursue will be gone and be given to AI. So the automatic, I guess, response to AI is, oh, well, manufacturing might be the first type of industry that gets crushed with computers. So
let me push back on that.
Okay.
Because, you know, look, I'm sitting here with my iPhone, right? And I'm doing this show on my laptop, you know, just as you are. And, you know, when computing first came out, we thought computing was going to kill millions of jobs, right? My iPhone is my friend, right? My laptop.
Yeah, I see what you're
saying.
I can't
function without them, right? They do things that I couldn't otherwise do. So the story of computing has been not a story of, yes, for sure there's been job displacement, but there has also been all kinds of complementary jobs that came about as a result of it.
True.
As people learn how to work with computers in the workforce and apply them. And then in addition, there's a whole new workforce that is in the computing side, aside from building computers, maintaining, operating, programming, developing the software for computers. Those are huge industries at this point. So that's been the story of computing. And I think AI is going to be more of that story than the massive job displacement story. That you bet there will be job displacement, but there will also be a lot of complementary work as we learn how to work with it. And then there will be new jobs created as well as we learn how to manage these tools. So manufacturing is a logical place for AI to go. But, you know, again, you're still going to have to make stuff, right? AI in the end is software. So the software can assist us in helping to analyze a lot of the tasks. Because the moment, manufacturing is a whole bunch of separate machines on the factory floor. And too often, we haven't really thought about how to better run it as a system. AI can contribute to that, right? AI can contribute on design. So this task that AI is going to help with in manufacturing. But I think there's going to be the same kind of mix as we had in computing. Yes, some job displacement, but a lot of complementary jobs as we learn how to work with it. And then third, there's going to be new jobs too.
True. I think that there is an incredible opportunity for entrepreneur-like people to use this technology for good. But when I see clients creating restaurants right now with no people working them, it's burgers being made by robots, I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, give it 20 more years. Where are we going with all this? It's getting scary out there. But I'm with you. I think that there's a lot of opportunity for people who are going to use this technology rather than be used by it. So I'm with you. One thing that I think potentially is in your book is, in order for this to work, politicians, governors, presidents, they need to make the United States or certain states very friendly. They need to create incentives and rewards for businesses to come in and want to be a manufacturing plant there. I see a lot of blue states making it very hard for manufacturers to want to move there and build businesses. So do you agree that maybe some politicians got to get on this train and say, let's make it as easy as possible for manufacturers to come here and build?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And look, we also need these pieces in place around scale-up financing for manufacturing. And if we want new companies to enter into hard tech, right, because we need the new ideas that come out of entrepreneurs and new companies, we're going to have to make venture capital available at significant scale for hard tech, not just for software.
Mm-hmm.
Turning around that signaling system so that it works for hard tech as well as soft tech, I think is going to be a key step here. So there's a lot to get done. The states are going to play a big role. The feds are going to play a big role here too.
Yeah. And I think that, inflation and everything that's coming down the road here, inflation starting to spike up. But you start to see with all these wars, I'm talking to a lot of entrepreneurs I know who run big companies. They're a little nervous. It seems like this is a crazy time in the economy. I would love to see manufacturing come back. Do you think that there's a possibility to see it in the next 10, 15, 20 years? What's your optimism level?
You got the right timetable. It's going to be, it's going to take that kind of timetable. It's not going to fit an election cycle, right? But I do think that the technology is sitting there and there's an opportunity to pick it up. And what we've got to do, it would be one thing if the technology wasn't there, but there's a host of technologies that could really be transformative in manufacturing in the same kind of way that technology transformed mass production through interchangeable machine-made parts, in the same kind of way that new precision technologies enabled Japan's quality revolution, right? We can do that. We could create a new production paradigm here. And we need to, because frankly, our competitors are moving on it. Germany has twice as many robots per worker than the U.S. does. But remember that Germany pays manufacturing wages than our manufacturing employees get to.
Wow, I didn't know that.
They've managed to figure out, enable them to capture some very important sectors in production. So if Germany can do it, it's not mission impossible for the U.S. to do it, right?
Yeah.
We think that we have to lose manufacturing jobs because we have high wages here. But somebody forgot to send that memo to Germany, right? And they're incredibly, they got almost 20% of their population in manufacturing jobs. We have 8% now, right? And those are good jobs. So yeah, we could do this. We just got to get the pieces together that enable us to do it. And a lot of it's going to be innovation around introducing new technologies into manufacturing, creating the incentives for companies to do that, turning around this scale-up financing problem, getting venture into hard tech. Those are all pieces, I think, of the puzzle. And then the workforce education issue. If we don't have the workers ready to implement it, it's not going to happen.
And you start that at a young age. It's not just within your advanced degrees. You're talking about early on, get the workforce set up for this, right? Get them.
Yeah, exactly. I think we really need in this country an apprenticeship system. Those have worked well in a whole bunch of European countries, very successful for their populations. They really, really cut youth unemployment rates, provide real opportunities for kids. And look, this is America. You know, we're going to have, Germany's system is you pick your trade when you're, when you're quite young. We're not going to do that here, right? Our country is going to want people to have a lot of choices at every stage of their careers. But we can build an apprenticeship system that allows that and still enable skill development. And, it's breaking this gap down between learning and work, I think, is going to be a central part of the story.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think you'd be better off getting into manufacturing than some of the degrees that I'm hearing people take whenever you go to college, right?
That's no question.
The chance of them getting a job that, number one, is there. Number two, that pays them well. Number three, that gets them out of debt. Very, very, very low.
Yeah. And look, in an apprenticeship system, you earn and learn.
Damn right.
You're on the job, you're making money, and, that enables you to afford that higher education step too. So, I've seen, apprenticeship programs where that works really well, including in the United States.
Hmm. Nice. So one question we always ask our guests is that outside of your own book, Is there one that you recommend? Maybe it comes down to more manufacturing advice, or maybe one that helps people think more like an entrepreneur. Is there a book that stands out in your life that you recommend to our audience? Because it seems like you're very well read by looking at your background, an insane library in your house. So one that you recommend you for us.
You know, there's a guy named John Cowell, K-A-O, who wrote a terrific book, called Innovate America. And that's a classic, I think, in the kind of innovation literature. And, I recommend that. It's the story of how the U.S. can take the kind of dynamic parts of our society and really turn them towards innovation in a very challenging and interesting kind of way.
Innovate America. That's the book?
Yeah.
So you seem like a Mike Rowe guy. Do you like Mike Rowe?
You know, I haven't read a lot of them, Mike.
Okay. Mike Rowe he's obviously a big name on TV, and he talks about dirty jobs, and he really brings to the surface of how detrimental it is if we get away from, like you said, the apprenticeships and trade businesses and manufacturing companies. So he's really sharing your message out there. You should check him out. But what do you attribute it to more than anything else? Do you think that Americans got lazy? Do you think there's a culture that took over that said, you know, hard work is bad. Let's go to the white collar jobs. Let me get into more of a position that I don't have to get my hands dirty. I don't have to really do anything. What do you think where does it all come down to?
So look, American culture is powerful, right? And it's a very hardworking culture, and it's a very innovative culture. Those are great things about the American culture. I think the story about what happened here was that, we got ourselves into a situation where we lost one third of our manufacturing jobs between 2000 and 2010, right? No parent in their right mind is going to recommend their kids go into manufacturing, given that recent history, right?
Yeah,
that's very real, right? So the parents are diverting their kids out of that into, you know, white collar kind of jobs that, of course, in the services sector have been better paying, depending on what part of the white collar sector you're in, but can be better paying and more stable. And when we nailed the manufacturing sector, and why did we do it? You know, a whole bunch of economists told us that, you know, we were losing manufacturing jobs because we were getting more productive, right? Well, that turned out not to be the case, right? U.S. productivity has actually been declining or stagnating for about 15 years, including in manufacturing. Instead, it wasn't improved efficiency in manufacturing. We were actually facing output declines in that same period in 15 of our 19 manufacturing sectors that we measure. And in two of them, we were completely overstating output. So, you know, as a result of that, we closed 60,000 factories in that 2000 to 2010 period. What was the cause? The cause turned out to be international competition, particularly from Asia and especially from China. Right. And they were producing lower cost, but increasingly quality goods. And we just weren't competing with them. We were outsourcing like crazy to those countries and not taking on the production challenge in our own country. Well, it's time to turn that around.
Hmm. All right. Last question I have for you. You can answer it or you don't have to. You seem like a really nice guy. I don't want to rock the boat, but we're in an election year. All right. We got two candidates running. Who do you think is best for the manufacturing industry?
You know, interestingly, both candidates have been talking about manufacturing a lot, right? Finally, the issue of manufacturing is actually on the political landscape, right? That's very important. That's a really important and positive development. You know, I'll tell you, Mike, when I look at what Donald Trump did on manufacturing, which is essentially raise tariffs on Chinese goods, right? Fine. Let's recognize that a completely open trading system that allows us to get underbid, that's not a perfect system to say the least, right? But there's other stuff that's got to happen too. And I see Biden picking up a lot of that stuff, right? His policies on semiconductors, I think, make a lot of sense. Really putting that's an absolutely critical national security sector. He's really hustled to kind of get the deals in place that are going to restore the U.S. to a lot of semiconductor leadership. And he's been improving these advanced manufacturing institutes and taking a bunch of steps as well. So I'm hopeful that whoever the candidate is next year, that we're going to see a lot of attention on manufacturing, and some of the stuff that I've been writing about might get picked up.
It's great, man. Yeah. Great political answer too. You didn't rock the boat. That's great.
I didn't rock the boat.
my guests or my audience doesn't hate you because you didn't pick one or the other. All right. But anyways,
I meant what I said too.
Well, Bill Bonvillain, I have to say this has been fun to talk with you. I don't talk to too many people who have an extensive background in this world like you do. So it's been fun to talk with you. Guys, his book is called Advanced Manufacturing, The New American Innovation Policies. And Bill, is there a way for people to get in touch with you via a website or a social media channel that you recommend?
Yeah, I've got a website.
And what's that website? I think I have it in the notes. I can pull it up if you need.
It's Bonvillain.org, www.bonvillain.org.
Got it. Okay, yeah. Bonvillain.org, got it. All right, so we'll put that in the notes too. And he's easy to find on LinkedIn. That's how we found you. So I got to say, Bill, thanks so much for being here. 2024 is going to be a year of chaos. Hopefully, manufacturing does come back. And look up his book, guys, Advanced Manufacturing, Keep the American Dream Alive. And remember, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.